This is the very tippy top of Vulture Peak.
You broke back a rock?
Yep. Climbed up and broke off the top and stealthily hid it away because it's probably a Indian government offense to steal Vulture Peak.
Disappearing stone by stone.
Yeah. If every pilgrim that went to Vulture Peak since the time of Buddha took a stone like this, Vulture Peak would no longer exist.
That's the definition of a
Kalpa. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Are you in trouble?
I don't know.
For breaking a vow? Yeah.
Depends if you all tell.
Have you got your repentance?
I'm sorry if anyone was hurt by us taking this piece of Vulture Peak home, but I hope it's of benefit to beings, because now Vulture Peak is in this assembly, then this assembly is on Vulture Peak. Here, you can pass it around. This is the shrine, yeah. And this stone was undoubtedly there at the time the Buddha held up the flower on Vulture Peak, watching silently. And so in that way, the Mahakashapa's smile is part of this stone, and the stone is now part of our assembly. How wonderful that actually four people in this session climbed Vulture Peak together a couple years ago. Me and Shoho and Yaro and Ken. Yeah? We all went to pilgrimage in India. And Vulture Peak was one of the places. And as you go up Vulture Peak, there's many people selling flowers. And fruit. Maybe those flower sellers are world-honored ones holding up their flowers and saying, only 5 rupees, please. And I think many of us try to walk very quickly past them because it's hard to open to the radiance of the world-honored one selling flowers on Vulture Peak. And then as soon as one buys a flower or fruit on Vulture Peak as an offer to carry to the top and offer to the Buddha, the monkeys come and try to steal them from you. There's a large pack of aggressive monkeys on Vulture Peak. Big ones.
Well fed.
Yeah, well fed, but not fed enough. Yeah. And if you can make it through past all the flower sellers and monkeys, you can reach the top of Vulture Peak, where it's very quiet. And our assembly sat zazen peacefully on Vulture Peak.
It's about 400 steps you have to it, though.
Many steps. Many steps. It's a hike.
And don't forget the caves. I was especially struck by Ananda's cave.
Yep, Ananda's cave and Mahakashapa's cave.
Oh, Mahakashapa.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Buddha and his disciples like to hang out on Vulture Peak, especially the caves are cool because I remember that hike up there, sweating on this blazing Indian sun. But it's indeed very peaceful on the top. I think I maybe have been to Vulture Peak 4 or 5 times, and always just like to sit zazen on the top of Vulture Peak. It's very small, actually, even though a vast assembly of beings congregated there. It's where the sutras say that the Prajnaparamita sutras were taught and the Lotus Sutra was taught, but it's only really only about as big as this zendo. The flat area at the top. That wasn't a problem though for the Buddha. The assembly could fit anyway. Yeah, the flowers and the smiles. So, for those joining today, this is the story we're talking about in the record of transmitting the light. The first ancestor was Mahakashyapa. Once the world-honored one held up a flower and blinked on Vulture Peak, and Kashyapa smiled, and the world-honored one said, "I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, and I entrust it to Mahakashyapa." It was a wordless meeting of minds. It was a wordless accord. A wordless communication and affirmation. And you know, these are another kind of flower, these curved sticks. And as I recall, in ages long ago, at a Green Dragon Temple, Dharma teacher Tenshin, naturally real Roshi, was somewhat dismayed by the what was called this Zen temple, the smoking area. It used to be in the pool deck, the pool area under a little roof so you could smoke when it rained. Nowadays, I think to smoke at Green Gulch, you have to go way out to the outer parking lot. But it was kind of right in the center of Green Gulch, but enclosed in the old, distant ages past. And he was just dismayed by it because it wasn't being taken care of. It was like piles of like cigarette butts and ashes were, you know, covering the table, and lots of dirty coffee cups piled up there. For some reason, it was like in the center of the temple. It was this place that was always like a mess. Was he around when the smoking area was there? It was previous kalpas ago. And there were these, somehow announcements were made and it never seemed to work and it never seemed to get cleaned up. But there was, part of the mess there were these old vinyl chairs, like pool chairs with those vinyl strips, you know? There was like pool chairs, right? Made up of soft vinyl strips, and they were falling apart and mildewy. It was just part of the mess. But one time Dharma teacher tension, like pulled off one of those broken strips of the chair, and you know they go like this, and then they wrap around the metal at the end, right? So it was naturally shaped like this, like this. It's just like this is like the chair bottom, and then each end wraps around the metal things. So there was this vinyl, flimsy sort of vinyl thing, but that held its shape. And he brought it into the Zendo for a while and used it as this stick.
Did anybody notice it was a smoker?
I think maybe noticed, because the area started getting cleaner.
Either that or it was just the puja of holding it.
Maybe, yeah. But I was wondering if maybe it was like this, you know, piece of vinyl, broken, dirty mess was picked up as a flower and suddenly seen as a flower, and then there was a kind of like silent transmission, and the assembly, without anything being said anymore, this area just started getting cleaner. My memory is something like that. So the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, that doesn't need to be communicated in words. It's a separate transmission outside the sutras. Sometimes things work like this in the saha world we live in. So the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the storehouse of the true Dharma wisdom eye, the womb of the true Dharma eye, are different ways to say this phrase. What is this treasury, storehouse, womb, that hosts all the Dharma eyes? The treasury. And what is this eye that has it? For those who were here in the beginning of Sesshin, we heard how the Buddha said, I, together with the great earth and all beings, realize the way, when he saw the morning star. And then our commentator Kizan said, we must understand this eye. This eye is not Shakyamuni, but Shakyamuni comes forth from this eye. Mm-hmm. Now here in this story, the Buddha again says, I have this treasury. But we know now that I is not Shakyamuni. Buddha doesn't have the treasury. I have the treasury. The big I that's like extends all the way past the furthest heavens and all the way down through the lowest hells. I alone am the world honored one, and I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, the complete, bright, signless Dharma gate, and I entrust this to Mahakashyapa, because Mahakashyapa is another I, and you are another I. No one is not this I, but we think that we're Kokyo and Victor and so on. So, continuing Kazan's commentary to this story, if you intimately study the way and investigate carefully, not only is Mahakashyapa not extinct, but Shakyamuni abides eternally. Therefore, the wondrous mind of Nirvana, which has been directly indicated and intimately transmitted before you were born, has burgeoned and spread everywhere from antiquity to the present. Monks, don't yearn for the antiquity of 2,000 years ago. If you just wholeheartedly practice the way today, Bendo, wholehearted practice of the way, Kashyapa has not yet entered Mount Kukutapada, where he is waiting for Maitreya to come, but he can appear here in Japan and America. Shakyamuni's fleshly body will be warm right now, and Kashyapa's smile will be renewed again. Keizan's always bringing up these old stories and then saying, but they're not really just old stories, they have to be present right now. And in general, I think during Sesshin, we can listen to these stories and explore the intricacies intimately, carefully investigate these points. But as the day goes on and the days go on, if we get confused and forget all about these stories, the bottom line in Sesshin, I would say, right now is right now. The bottom line is presence. Whatever practice we're doing, whether we don't even have any practice at all, like I'm just sitting here and I don't know what to do, well, present moment is the key. If we're counting the breath, following the breath, that's only because the breath is happening right now. It's the present experience. If we're have a open monitoring practice of attending to every sense field wide open, same thing, present experience is all. If we're turning the light around and asking who is the host, this is happening right now, no other time and place. So well, however diverse our practices may be, if we get confused and forget returning to this present moment, everything is happening here. If unsurpassed great awakening is to unfold, it can never do so at any other time than right now. So, maybe obvious, but so simple, whatever practice we're doing. Simple but difficult, right? Because we're so accustomed to thinking about the past and the future. Because they seem more interesting in the moment. But in fact, I think this is one of the gifts of Sesshin, is that the truly opening to the presentness of the present is so much more interesting than the most fascinating thought about the past or future. It's just that if we're not quite open to it, it's like, yeah, the present is somewhere, I know I'm supposed to do that, but yeah. Then it's like, then it's not that interesting. If we're like creeping around the edges of the present, it seems almost like torture sometimes. The present is like the epitome of extreme boredom. It seems like when you're a little bit outside it, right? Anything I could think about would be more interesting than this, because nothing's happening right here now. But actually, when we like come to rest in the present, whatever other practice we may be doing, it's like that's most alive, it seems. I would even say, if we're bored, occasionally I might get bored sitting period after period. I feel like, in my experience, if I'm bored, I'm actually a little bit off the present. A little bit like blocking the present. What's so great about the present anyway? Kazan goes on, if you can reach this place, which this translation is a little like toned down, I think. I would translate imo no denji as if you can reach the field ground of suchness. Suchness's field or ground. If you can reach the ground of suchness, you will be a successor to Kashyapa, and Kashyapa will receive the Dharma from you. Not only does it come down to you from the seven ancient Buddhas, but you will be able to be the ancestral teacher of the seven ancient Buddhas. Beginningless and endless, beyond past and present, here is the abiding place of the entrusting of the treasury of the true Dharma I. For this reason, Shakyamuni also received the entrustment from Kashyapa, who dwells now in Tushita heaven, the heavens of the satisfied, and you also abide in the assembly of Vulture Peak, unchanging. Are you not familiar with the expression? Quote, when being, for uncountable kalpas, I abide on sacred Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place. When living beings see the kalpas end with awe consumed in a great blaze, my domain stays serene and calm, ever filled with human and heavenly beings. Unquote. Are you not familiar? I know Patrick knows this. Yes, we chant this.
Almost Friday night.
Yeah. It's the Friday night sutra.
Yeah.
little did Kazan know when he was talking to his assembly in ancient Japan that some of the assembly in Santa Cruz would be familiar with those very lines. How wonderful. Which was taught on Vulture Peak. So he's, I think he's relating this particular line in the sutra to this story of holding up the flower. Thomas Cleary even says kind of matter-of-factly, this story of the Buddha holding up the flower and Mahakashyapa smiling is just it's the Zen version of the Lotus Sutra. That's why it happened on Vulture Peak. And he particularly says it's this part, I think he's referring to this part of the Lotus Sutra where the Buddha's sitting with the assembly on Vulture Peak and says, you've all heard my teaching many times before, and some of you are arhats, worthy ones, abiding in the complete peace of nirvana. So you might think there's nothing more to hear, but actually the true wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra is about to blossom on Vulture Peak here. So get ready for it. Here it comes. And I think it was 500 arhats, enlightened sages that had realized the peace of nirvana, they got up and left. Can you believe it? They like walked out on their teacher because he's like, he's gonna get into some like weird cosmic thing, I think, and like, we're already at peace, and why would we need some new Lotus Sutra thing? He's just messing with us. There's no more peace than this. And in fact, he better not mess with it because I like my peace. Anyone who would walk out on the Buddha maybe is a little bit attached to their own current version of peace. Right? But they left. And the Buddha said, well, they weren't ready for this. So it's just as well. They kind of had to leave. And now the lotus flower is going to blossom. And the one vehicle, the field of suchness, the host within the host will be revealed. And then he goes on to speak of all these other practices that he taught, including nirvana, were just skillful means and kind of expedient teachings to warm people up to the wondrous dharma of the one vehicle. So it was kind of this special transmission to those who were open to it at the time on Vulture Peak, the Lotus Sutra was. So the Zen version gets even simpler, and it's just a one-to-one meeting with just a flower and a smile. So it's like the summary of the Lotus Sutra, the Zen version of the Lotus Sutra. But this section that Kazon just quoted of the Lotus Sutra that we chant from the eternal lifespan of the Tathagata chapter of the Lotus Sutra, for uncountable kalpas, the Buddha says in this chapter, I appear to have lived for 80 years on this earth and enter nirvana. But truly I am not extinct, ever dwelling here to voice the Dharma. For uncountable kalpas, I abide on sacred Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place, like here, there, and everywhere. I eternally abide, this is Shakyamuni saying, again, not I, Siddhartha Gautama, that one, that flesh body lived for 80 years. But I, again, right, I abide on sacred Vulture Peak for uncountable kalpas. When living beings see the kalpa's end, this kalpa's end, this eon's end, with everything consumed in a great blaze, my domain stays serene and calm, ever filled with human and heavenly beings. You get a sense of that? As the guests are burnt up in the great fire at the end of the eon, the host stays serene and calm. The host stays serene and calm. My domain stays serene and calm. My field, ground of suchness. This place, Kazon says, we must reach. It stays serene and calm, and yet it's filled with human and heavenly beings. This field, this domain is serene and calm. Nothing's happening in it, And yet, it's also filled with human and heavenly beings and flowers and mountains and rivers and so on, which come and go, while it does not come and go. So Kazan quotes this section about the eternal lifespan of the Tathagata, and then says, Vulture Peak is not the only abode of the Dharma. How could India, China, Japan, and America be excluded? How do you know about America?
Yeah, as
you say. The Tathagata's true Dharma is entrusted, and not so much as a hair of it is lost. If this is so, the assembly here must be the assembly of Vulture Peak, and Vulture Peak must be this assembly. On the basis of your diligence or lack of diligence, the Buddha appears or does not appear. We talked about that too, about the age of decline, and these Zen ancestors' take on the age of decline is that through our practice and diligence, the true Dharma can be renewed in the age of decline. And also from this lifespan of the Tathagata chapter of the Lotus Sutra, it talks about this point. Kazan doesn't quote this, but this came to mind when he said, on the basis of your diligence or lack of diligence, the Buddha either appears or does not appear. And the Lotus Sutra says, when beings have become sincerely faithful or trust this host, honest and upright, with gentle intention, wholeheartedly wishing to behold the Buddha, not begrudging their own bodily lives, then I and the assembled Sangha appear together on sacred Vulture Peak. Then I tell the living beings that in this world I abide without end by the power of expedient means, appearing to be extinct or not. So, when beings become sincerely faithful, honest and upright, with gentle intention, wholeheartedly wishing to see the Buddha, not holding back on their practice, then I and the assembled Sangha appear together on sacred Vulture Peak. So Kazan says, on the basis of your diligence or lack of diligence, and we might add in, on the basis of your sincere trust, your honesty and uprightness, and gentle intention and wholehearted wish to meet the Buddha appears or does not appear. The host is always hosting the show, but it's not really that it never comes and goes, but it could appear to us, or we could realize accord with it, depending on our diligence and trust. Sincerely faithful or trusting, I think, is an important point in the Zen tradition. We hear these teachings and they maybe sound kind of wacky, but we can deepen our trust. Could it be that there's a host that can't be grasped, that doesn't come and go, that's nothing special, actually, that's just our ordinary awareness right now, without this reification of the external world? Mm-hmm. It's not a spiffed up kind of awareness. It's just that one turning point. Does this awareness reach out and touch objects or not? Can we touch it or not?
Is this what is meant when the sutra says this is the host within the host?
Yeah, Dongshan says the host within the host, if we can realize continuity, this is the host within the host. A lot could be said about that, because there's a whole, that dual mirror samadhi has this whole dialectic about host and guest that plays out in what we call the five ranks or five positions of Dongshan. And so it's kind of a complex topic, the relationship of host and guest, and it kind of culminates in this in this dual mirror samadhi poem as the host within the host. But that is the host that we're referring to here, the host within the host, which doesn't exclude the guests either. That's this whole five ranks business. It's like that, how the guests are hosts as well, and the hosts are guests as well. Those five relationships of host and guest. Today, also, if you practice the way wholeheartedly, incessantly, and master it in detail, Venerable Shakyamuni will forthwith appear. It's only because you've not clarified the self that Venerable Shakyamuni entered nirvana in ancient times. Can you follow that? And self here, jiko is like a big self, I think we could say here. Your true self, which is another name for the host, right? Another name for the eternal Shakyamuni, always abiding on Vulture Peak and every other dwelling place. If we haven't clarified that self, then Shakyamuni entered nirvana a long time ago. He's gone. Since you are the children of the Buddha, why do you kill the Buddha? By not realizing who he is, we could say. Therefore, you must practice the way wholeheartedly at once and encounter, meet your compassionate father promptly. Mutually, this word shokan means mutual seeing. And it's like still used in Rinzai Zen tradition, as I understand it, like the first Dokusan. It's like a kind of special ceremonial Dokusan when a student comes to the teacher. They do this in America, in Rinzai Zen. And in that meeting, they call it Shoken, the same word here, mutual seeing. So, since you're, if you practice the way wholeheartedly right now, you mutually see your compassionate father, and he mutually sees you. Daily, the old fellow Shakyamuni and you walk about, stand in place, sit and lie down together, and you have words together without even a moment of separation. Yeah? You know what he's talking about now, and this Buddha who's always with us. When we sit, lie down, walk, and stand, if in this life you do not become acquainted with this old fellow, this old gal, then you will be thoroughly unfilial. This is your father. Also in the dual mirror samadhi, we say, ministers serve their lords, children obey their parents. Not obeying is not filial, and not serving is no help. This is exactly the same point, right? It's all these different metaphors for the host and guest, the father and child, the lord and servant. Not serving is no help. serving the host while the host serves us. Since you are Buddha's children, then if you're unfilial, not even the hands of 1,000 Buddhas will help. Today, this descendant of Daijo Monastery, which is Tetsu Gikai Monastery, that's his teacher, Keizan's teacher, Tetsu Gikai, and Daijo-ji means Great Vehicle Monastery, Mahayana Temple. Today, this descendant of Mahayana, successor of Tetsu Gikai, would like to say a few humble words to point to this principle. Do you want to hear them? His verse reads, "Know that in a remote place, in a cloud-covered misty valley, there is still a sacred pine that passes through the chill of the ages." Maybe celebrating Mahakashapa, the solitary pine that passes through the chill of ages. Anything anyone wants to bring up about the eternal Shakyamuni or the host? In that case,
what was Keizan's line that preceded your understanding of practicing at the present moment?
Well, he's talking about this might have been the place, if you just wholeheartedly practice the way today, Kashyapa has not entered this mountain where he waits for Maitreya, and Shakyamuni, and Kashyapa can appear right here in this country. This is always about today, right now, and here. And I think I brought it up just as a kind, almost like as an aside, even though Keizan is talking about it. Brought it up just as a reminder when we, we might say, well, this is all this weird Zen language, I don't understand this whole transmission of light thing, and therefore I'm just gonna bide my time through the hours of Sesshin fantasizing about when it will be over. Can you imagine such an experience?
Yes.
And therefore, it was the encouragement. We can keep hearing these stories have a life of their own, so they're going to keep pouring out. They can't be stopped. but wherever we're at with it, to remember the simplicity of the present moment. The simplicity of the present moment. And how whatever practice we're doing, however plain or super fancy our practice might be, that's the criteria, I think, for any practice of Zazen, is it's like engaging the present moment. It's not speculating about some other time and place. Even if we're doing like reasoning and investigative insight practice, which is wonderful practice too, it seems to me that it only works if we're actually investigating what's happening right now. If we're theoretically thinking about, let's see, when a seed ends and a sprout arises, do they meet or not? Things like this. There's room for that kind of questioning, but I think in Zazen it's more like this body and mind, when this breath ceases and the next one arises, do they meet or not? Like if we're always investigating our actual body and mind experience, then it's alive. Yes.
Yeah, so that comes to mind is something we were chanting this morning. I'm wondering if it's related. Like if those touch, like this first breath or this first inhale, does it touch the next exhale? We were chanting something about winter to spring.
Yeah.
Wood,
firewood to ash.
And
yes.
Bread to toast.
Yeah. Same. Yeah, actually. Yeah, bread does not become toast. In the Buddha's teaching, it's an unshakable truth that bread does not become toast. Bread abides in the phenomenal expression of bread, in the Dharma position of bread that fully includes past and future, but also it means it's that bread is dependent on all the past things, and it's in the big picture, it's dependently arising with its future states. It's completely interdependent throughout space and time, and it's independent of past and future. This is Dogen's wonderful Genjo Koan. This bread completely depends on all these conditions, and this bread is independent. We say, well, how could anything be independent? But it's kind of like abiding in its Dharma position. In this one moment, there's nothing but this bread here. There's no, you know, there's nothing else. And then that ceases. That bread is like gone. And another Dharma position of a bread with like a little spot of mold on it arises. But it's not the same bread as the one just before the mold spot. So, abiding in his Dharma position. And then it comes out of the toaster, or something comes out of the toaster as toast. And that toast is dependent on the bread, completely dependent on the bread. But it doesn't come from the bread. But if we start thinking about bread too much in Zazen, we might get hungry. And I also thought of, as we were chanting that beautiful Genjo Koan, many lines stood out in reference to our studies this week, like the moon, the part about the moon. Although its light is wide and great, the moon is reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. So this moon is the host, and we're saying the host, these are all Zen words we're getting familiar with, but if we don't mind losing our eyebrows, we can say things like, what we're talking about here is this ordinary awareness. There's an awareness of what's happening right now, and if we're aware of this awareness, it has no edges or boundaries, and it's not distinct from the things in it, actually. We can't, I mean, in our direct experience, putting aside all teachings we've ever heard about this, investigating this awareness, we can't get a hold of it, and yet, it's like, it's filled with life. It is life, is it not? And yet, it seems like there's a me aware of an object. And that's the kind of like illusion happening in this big open space called boundless awareness. The host. So the moon, the whole moon and the entire sky are reflected even in a puddle an inch wide. Like each of us is like a little puddle, right? And the moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. This is a wonderful, poetic description of the unity of the two truths. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken. The moon is completely reflected in the water, but nothing can wet the moon. It's untouchable, it's unshakable, it's ungraspable. Nothing can destroy it, nothing can wet it. The moon does not get wet, nor is the water broken by the moon. The sentient being is not, like, eliminated by this awareness. It lives quite nicely. In other words, the guest is not broken by the host. The depth of the drop is the height of the moon. The host fills each guest exactly without any difference in any guest and without any separation. And I also thought of this story that what happened when Kashyapa his eyes were open and his face cracked. A smile rose. Without contrivance, without thinking, without effort, accord, a wordless accord. So I thought when Dogen said to carry the self forward and experience myriad things is delusion. So it could be that this assembly on Vulture Peak waiting for the Dharma talk was like, we're here, I'm here at the Dharma talk, here I am, come on Buddha, do it, give it to us, the talk. It's going to begin with something like, oh monks, listen up. And before he says that, I'll take a little nap here. When he says, oh monks, listen up, then I'll listen up, because I know that's when the Dharma talk starts, because I've been to many of Buddha's Dharma talks, and that's how it works. I know who I am, I know what a Dharma talk is, I know what's going to happen here. I'm waiting, and I'm like sitting, and you know, this is serious business here, actually, too, because the Buddha's giving a Dharma talk. So you could say to carry the self forward and experience that assembly on Vulture Peak was delusion, so they didn't get it. But the myriad things coming forth and experiencing themselves or the self is awakening. It's not so much that Mahakashyapa said, now if I smile, I'll receive the treasury of the true Dharma eye and they'll put me in the record of the ancestors. It's more like he was just open. It wasn't carrying himself forward to try to get the Dharma talk, just receiving. When the myriad things come forth and confirm oneself, this is awakening, Dogen says. We could say that's the commentary on the meeting at Vulture Peak. Maybe also in the Lotus Sutra, the Myoho Renge Kyo, the Wondrous Dharma Lotus Flower Sutra, which is usually abbreviated in Japan. Instead of saying the Lotus Sutra like we do in America, they say the Hoke Sutra, the Dharma Flower Sutra. It's the standard shorthand for Lotus Sutra in China and Japan. The Dharma Flower Sutra. So in this Dharma Flower Sutra, the assembly of arhats. Well, was there any self to carry forward for an arhat? Usually it was, he said, not really, but maybe the sutra implied there's some subtle pride, maybe, something like that, that they were like, well, the Buddha's going to do something new here, but we already have it all, so there's a little something being carried forward, so... And with the thought that they were enlightened, they left the lotus flower assembly, and the those who remained were open. They were open, so they let the myriad things come forth and experience themselves.
And the difference between an arhat, I mean, I'm not sure.
Yeah, arhats are like in the pre-Mahayana. We might say, according to the Mahayana, the small vehicle, the more the incomplete vehicle, we might say. The goal is arhat. To be an arhat means worthy one, and it's to realize nirvana, personal nirvana, freedom from suffering, and cessation, and therefore no more birth and death. And whereas the Mahayana, the great vehicle, complete path, is the Bodhisattva vehicle, where one does realize this nirvana. But it's a more open relationship to it. So it's called non-abiding nirvana. So, which means not abiding in nirvana or samsara. And it means that then we don't mind living in the world of appearances of birth and death as bodhisattvas. In fact, we vow to keep living in the appearing world for the benefit of all beings, based on great compassion. So that's the Mahayana twist. Is it greatly honors the arhats. So like noon service dedication, we dedicate it to these 16 arhats because there's amazing practitioners. But then also we vow to go beyond. That's the Lotus Sutra, saying there's something more than the arhat. So the arhats didn't want to hear that. They left. Now the Buddha's like, there's something that's just inconceivably wonderful, flowering here, that's from which nothing is excluded, even birth and death. Sometimes say the arhats are like extremely afraid of the slightest suffering. Therefore, they want to enter cessation as quickly as possible. Whereas the bodhisattvas, because they understand that suffering is not what we think it is, they're willing to live in the apparent world of pain and suffering in order to help wake everybody up from the illusion. It's really quite a radical thing, I think, this bodhisattva idea. You know, I think sometimes maybe we water it down and we'll be like, well, we don't need this arhat thing, we don't need this realization thing. We're just into like being good people and helping, which is important, part of the bodhisattva path, but in a way the realization itself is even more profound than the arhats, because it's the total unity of the two truths in order to help people. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.